Thanks for being with us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mehler here, turning our attention to phosphorus now and a new book about it. Phosphorus, of course, is one of the ingredients of life, but it can also lead to death, environmental destruction. And we're going to learn, you will and I will learn more about that element as we talk about the book, The Devil's Element, and the subtitle, Phosphorus and a World Out of Balance. Our guest, author and journalist Dan Egan, with us today. He also wrote the Life and Death of the Great Lakes. Dan's a two-time finalist for the Pulitzer Prize, winner of the Los Angeles Times Book Prize. I interviewed Dan when his book, The Life and Death of the Great Lakes, was selected by the University of Wisconsin in the Go Big Read that we have every year on the UW-Madison campus. So, and this is another great book here. What have you been told about phosphorus? I learned an awful lot in this book, and it's made a big impact on how I look at phosphorus, and probably will on you as well. I hope you'll join the conversation. Has it made a mark on your community, phosphorus? Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or you can send us an email to ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. Dan Egan, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Good to be here.
Tell you what, I loved your first book. What inspired you to write about phosphorus?
Well, it really was a spinoff from that first book, The Death and Life of the Great Lakes. One of the chapters in that book dealt with Lake Erie and the algae troubles that big Great Lake has been suffering in the past couple of decades, and that required some research into the causes, and that took me down a rabbit hole called phosphorus. And so I just kind of filed it away as I was writing the Great Lakes book. I remember at the time thinking, wow, this is way more interesting than a book about the lakes. And and for a bunch of reasons. But so then the Great Lakes book came out, and then the publisher came back after a few months, and that book was doing well, and he asked if I had any other ideas, and I pitched him phosphorus. He didn't bite right away, but it didn't take him long, because it took me 2 years to sell the book proposal to a publisher on the book on the Great Lakes, and this took about 2 weeks. So he quickly saw the light, the phosphorescent light.
Okay. Well, you know, I've got a show on Fridays called Garden Talk, and phosphorus comes up a lot on that particular show, and mostly telling people not to use it or apply it because there's plenty of phosphorus already in most of our Wisconsin soils, and don't put it on your lawn for sure. But, you know, what phosphorus is, I'm not sure that everybody's acquainted with what it really is. Can you tell us about that? What is phosphorus?
Yeah, it's a little complicated, but I'll try to uncomplicate it. Phosphorus is an element. It's number 15 on, I won't say your periodic table, because nobody really has periodic tables anymore, but that's where it sits on the periodic table. It's called the devil's element because it was the 13th element discovered. And it's also, in its elemental form, really nasty stuff. And so when most people talk about phosphorus, they're talking about phosphate, which is the fertilizer. Elemental phosphorus doesn't belong in the natural world any more than a styrofoam cup. It's got to be refined and distilled to its essence. And that wasn't done until the 1600s, when this guy over in Hamburg, Germany, was trying to find what the alchemists used to call the philosopher's stone, which was some magical, mythical substance that could turn base metals like lead into gold. So the idea at the time was everything is evolving, and it's just a matter of time until lead becomes gold, and we can speed it along if we can tap the natural property that does this. That property being the philosopher's stone. And people thought it could be derived from all sorts of different things. And this guy in Germany thought it could be pulled from the human waste stream, urine specifically. So this is when my ears started perking up when I was doing research for the Great Lakes book. I learned that he cooked vats and vats of urine over a number of weeks at just white hot heat. Adding some of this and a dash of that, it's really kind of hocus pocus. The actual recipe is super complicated. But the end result was he cooked down the urine and then it vaporized and condensed. And what was left were these little, like, chocolate chip sized nuggets that glowed in the dark. It was phosphorus. And he didn't know what to do with them. They were just kind of a curiosity, but they're also really dangerous. A, they're poisonous, really poisonous. But B, when they get just a little bit above room temperature, warmed a little bit above, say, the 80 Fahrenheit, they just combust. And they burn like all get out at ungodly heat. And so it wasn't long before people figured out how to weaponize this stuff. And coincidentally, it's discovered in Hamburg, Germany in 1669. And then in 1943, the Allies destroy Hamburg with firebombs. The idea at the time, it was kind of revolutionary. Instead of dropping bombs to just blow things to smithereens, they would drop incendiary bombs to make a city burn itself down, kind of like turn buildings and all the stuff in those buildings and homes into fuel that can destroy the city. And that's exactly what they did. So that's the devil's element for you. That's the elemental stuff that is literally phosphorus. It doesn't have a lot of practical applications beyond it's been a rat poison, but it was really a weapon. It still is a weapon of war. It was referred to as Willy Pete during Vietnam, white phosphorus. And it's not, by the rules of war such as they are today, it's not supposed to be used in combat unless it's being used to illuminate the night sky or to provide a smoke screen because it kicks off a lot of smoke. But it's also a psychological weapon, really a weapon of terror, because when it explodes, it creates these globules that will burn right through a house down to the basement, and they'll burn right through a person as well. And they don't stop burning until it's all played out, unless it gets wet. And so that's really where this story starts, back in Hamburg, Germany, where people today are finding leftover nuggets of phosphorus along the banks of the Elbe River and along the shoreline of the nearby Baltic coast. People confuse it with amber because it looks like amber. They pick it up, they put it in the pocket, and boom. And that's how I opened the book.
Yeah, that was a harrowing story. Heck of a way to open the book. So that's
well, yeah. If you're going to write a book about phosphorus, you got to come out hard. So that's what I did. The poor gentleman, I mean, I went over there. He lived north of Hamburg. And I went over there in 2019 to talk to him, and it was really a scary experience. I mean, his pant leg, he was walking on the coast, and his pants just exploded. And he doesn't smoke, didn't have a lighter, and he instinctively went into the water, and that doused the flames. So when he came back out, it would flare up again. So they're going to bring in a helicopter, but they thought whatever it was would bring down the helicopter. He ended up being packed in wet towels and taken to a hospital via ambulance, and they pulled it out.
Yeah, so there's that aspect of it, but the aspect of how it came to be used as fertilizer, I thought was another interesting part of your book. And again, I loved how you bring so many people and so many stories into the book that really help our understanding.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, it was discovered as a fertilizer really by accident. In fact, we've been farming for 10,000 years, and people have always intuited that you can't grow a crop on the same plot of land over and over and over again unless you replenish whatever it was in the soil that allowed things to grow. And so the British were really pioneers in this several hundred years ago, and they would throw anything they could think of onto their land to grow turnips and wheat and whatnot. And they were always experimenting, and they'd use things like blood and human waste and fabric. And they struck on one substance that was really, really perfect for their soils. and that was bone shavings from some knife factory because the handles were made out of bone. So they didn't know that this was phosphorus is phosphate. I'm just going to keep it to phosphorus so things don't get confusing. They didn't know that it was phosphorus that made the bones such a potent fertilizer. They just knew that they wanted bones. And that took them to some pretty crazy places at the beginning of the 1800s. Specifically, it took them, like, the Battle of Waterloo.
Yes, I was just going to bring that up.
Yeah, like 40,000 people fell in, like, 10 hours, along with who knows how many horses. And, you know, normally you would expect some kind of mass grave of an ancient battlefield like that, and it would be, you know, holy land. And not so in early 1800s Britain. They went back several years after the war and looted or plundered or harvested, whatever you want to say, the bones of that battlefield. And there were plenty of them. I mean, there was 40,000 remains. And they built special factories to grind these bones up and to spread them on British cropland. And it worked magnificently. And they went looking for other bones, and wherever they could find bones, they would use them. But there wasn't an inexhaustible supply, so eventually they had to find another source of fertilizer. And they're beginning at this point to realize that it's phosphorus in the bones. But they didn't care so much about that. The only thing about phosphorus in fertilizer is they knew if it had a high content of phosphorus, it was going to be a good fertilizer. And that's true today. And just to jump ahead real quickly, today's modern fertilizer is phosphorus, nitrogen, and potassium. And yep, we don't have any problems with getting nitrogen since we've been able to pull it in the air since that process was discovered in the early 1900s. And there's lots of deposits of potassium, but our reserves of phosphorus are running low.
They are, and we're going to talk some more about that and about some of the problems that phosphorus is creating in all over the world, really, with our guest Dan Egan, who chronicles it in his book, a great new book, The Devil's Element, Phosphorus in a World Out of Balance. He's going to be with us right up until 12:30 today. We'll take a quick look at the news. We'll find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Network. And then we'll be back with Dan Egan. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network. Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. We're talking about the book, The Devil's Element, Phosphorus and a World Out of Balance, with our guest today, Dan Egan. He also wrote The Life and Death of the Great Lakes. He's a two-time finalist for the Pulitzer Prize, winner of the LA Times Book Prize. So are you concerned about phosphorus in the Great Lakes or in water near where you live? Maybe you're a farmer using fertilizer with phosphorus, or maybe you're dealing with how to get rid of your animal waste properly. Tell us what you think. Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or email to ideas@wpr.org. Phosphorus, kind of a great paradox, isn't it, Dan?
Yeah, absolutely, because on a couple of levels. But so I was talking earlier about how the British were using bones from battlefields to fertilize their crops. And when they ran out of bones, they went to the west coast of South America, to the Guano Islands. And bird poop is lousy with phosphorus. So they had these mountains of bird poop, and they thought at the time it was an inexhaustible source of fertilizer. And soon the rest of Europe, or much of Europe and the United States, followed along. And not surprisingly, in about 40 or 50 years, those inexhaustible supplies of fertilizer, bird-based fertilizer, were gone. So then they had to go hunting for more. Now the chemists are at work, and they can really dial in on phosphorus-rich material. And that led them to certain sedimentary rock deposits scattered around the world, but they're not evenly spread, equitably spread. In the U.S., this is where the paradox comes in. The U.S. has 30, 40 years maybe in its primary reserves down in Florida before those play out. And then we're going to be dependent largely dependent on other countries for our fertilizer. So when you think about oil or energy security, that's nothing compared to nutritional security, and that's where we're going to be headed. And most of the deposits left, the reserves left on Earth, 80% of them are in Morocco and Western Sahara. So that could be interesting. But at the same time, we're running low on this stuff. We're continuing to use it, you know, at a rate that is just not sustainable. And the consequences of that aren't just flowing through the phosphorus reserves that we have too quickly. They're also, the consequences are mean fouled waters, you know, and this isn't just a Great Lakes problem, but it's a huge problem in Lake Erie. It's a huge problem up in Green Bay, a big problem in Florida, and it's a big problem right in Madison, Lake Mendota, right? You know, sitting out on the terrace on a hot summer night, you'd like to go for a swim, but too often there's this spinachy goop in the water, and that's driven by an excess of phosphorus running off primarily from agriculture land. So that's the paradox. We're running out, and we're using it too fast.
Yeah.
And we're poisoning our waters along the way.
It's really something. I mean, you tell a great story about how phosphates were used in soaps. Procter & Gamble with its soaps, like 85% of the soap at one time for washing clothes, about 85% of it was phosphate.
Something like that. I don't remember the numbers, but yeah, it was the detergent concoctions of the 50s and 60s. You know, I used to think of soap and detergent as the same thing, but it's really like the difference between a skateboard and a rocket ship. There's so much technology that goes into detergents. And we didn't have a need for them until we had washing machines, and we didn't really have many washing machines until World War II was over, and we could use those factories to make home appliances instead of, you know, weapons of death. And so in the 50s and 60s, with all these washing machines in basements, they're kicking out this wastewater that's just really, it's a phosphorus soup, and that was making its way into water bodies across the country. And that was a big reason why the media in the 1960s was referring to Lake Erie, which is uniquely vulnerable among the Great Lakes because it's so warm and shallow, vulnerable to these toxic algae outbreaks, to the point where they're calling it, you know, America's Dead Sea.
Yeah.
And so at the time when they figured out that it was phosphorus in detergent causing this, that led to phosphorus being pulled from detergent formulas, and that really led to a fast and dramatic improvement in water quality, not just in the Great Lakes, but across the country. But now we're slipping backwards again, and this time it's not detergent. It's largely agriculture runoff.
Yeah, you talk about the Maumee Valley that feeds into Lake Erie. Talk about that.
Yeah, so the Maumee River, it flows through Toledo. And if you know the Fox River, the one up in Green Bay, it's like a sister river. It's just as hardworking, and it's about the same size. And it carries the waste burden of, I don't remember how many millions of acres of farmland. And that burden includes lots of phosphorus. And that's led to these toxic algae outbreaks since the late 90s that are so bad and so predictable that every year they have in early July or late June, they have basically a phosphorus or an algae forecast. And some of these slicks can be 2,000 square miles. I mean, they're just huge. And when, first of all, they're toxic, they're poisonous to pets. They can get humans really sick, and the toxin produced by some of this stuff has been implicated in deaths down in South America. Some toxic algae toxins got into the water supply at a dialysis center down in Brazil and killed like 50 some people. So it's not just unpleasant; it's dangerous. And Lake Erie is kind of the poster child, largely because in 2014, some of this stuff got sucked into the Toledo drinking water supply and knocked out their water for a number of days. And this wasn't a case of boil your water and you'll be fine, just give us a little time to get things under control. This was poisonous water that had made its way into the water treatment plant and out of it. And so when you think about like a baby needing formula and, you know, you don't have water, yet they called in the National Guard. They're bringing in baby formula by the pallets and truckloads of water for people to drink. And that just shook a lot of people, because here the Toledoans are on the banks of the world's largest freshwater system, and they can't safely drink their water, even with modern water treatment. So it's serious stuff, and it's spreading.
And the as you said, the Fox River is kind of similar in so many ways. And Brown County is a big agricultural county.
Yeah, it's my home county. And Brown County is a particularly apt name these days, given how many heads of cattle are in that watershed. There's too much manure for the landscape to handle, and that means there's too much manure going into the waters, and that is why, the Bay of Green Bay is too often in late summer just a soupy mess. I mean, Green Bay, the city of Green Bay, and this isn't a new phenomenon, but they pull their water all the way from Manitowoc. I think there's two pipes. The suburbs have one pipe, and the city itself has a pipe. So they're taking water out of Lake Michigan because Green Bay has just been too ravaged. And a big problem is phosphorus and the algae that it produces.
And the algae and the dangerous kind, I mean, it's really bacteria, aren't they?
Yeah, exactly. It's cyanobacteria is what they call it. And it's basically photosynthesizing bacteria. A big one is called Microcystis, and the toxin it produces is Microcystin. And yeah, I mean, it's natural stuff. It's responsible for kicking a lot of the oxygen into the atmosphere that we have on Earth today, some billions of years ago. So it's always played an essential role in the environment, but it's gotten a real boost from excess phosphorus. Because, I was talking earlier about bones and crops and agriculture. And what was going on for thousands of years was we were kind of living inside the circle of life that phosphorus stitches together, because it never goes away. It just gets recycled over and over again. But once we started building sewers and flushing the stuff straight into the water, the sea or the lakes, whatever you may be, then we turned that circle into a line. And we no longer started trying to reuse the phosphorus in so many forms. We primarily in waste, human waste and agricultural waste. We just started flushing it away. And that's not the way the stuff's supposed to be used. And that's why we have this growing toxic algae problem.
Yeah. Kim in Patch Grove, we'll give you a chance. Hi, Kim. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I hope I don't ramble. This, I guess, is just such a sore spot with me. Phosphorus is a very serious thing, and I totally understand. But I am a member on the village board of this small little community in Patch Grove. We were one of the very first communities that the DNR picked to start dealing with the phosphorus in our wastewater treatment plant. It's serious, and we all understand that. But what we are doing and the amount of money that we have paid out to engineers and fines and whatever else it is, it is doing nothing. The little creek that runs through our town, the phosphorus levels are way higher above and below than what we are discharging. The DNR has done nothing to offset what the agriculture is doing, but we're not making a difference at all in this. And I guess it's just frustrating. I wish it was kind of more equal, municipalities and agriculture together, not just the municipalities.
Uh-huh. And Kim, I'm glad you called, because this is Dan really addresses this in his book. Dan, talk about the Clean Water Act, for example, and what it does and what it doesn't do.
Yeah, I can completely sympathize with the caller's concerns, because we've gone a long way. There's still a ways to go, but we've gone a long way to reducing our phosphorus discharges through our wastewater treatment. And Wisconsin has now some of the tightest phosphorus laws on the books. The problem is, when the Clean Water Act was passed in 1972, following, the dead days of Lake Erie, the Dead Sea days of Lake Erie, it really only or primarily addressed municipal sources, like wastewater treatment sources of phosphorus, and industrial sources. it largely left alone agriculture because the thinking at the time was you can plug a pipe or cap a smokestack or at least control what's coming out of them. But when you're talking about diffuse wastes on the landscape, they're just too hard to measure, let alone regulate. So agriculture, and also, like, even if you were, like, how do you clean a farm field? You can't really squeegee it. So the thought at the time was, let's just leave agriculture out of this to a large extent, and we'll deal with the industrial sources. And it made sense at the time. But since then, you know, we've got more livestock, and the operations are getting bigger. And so when I talk about the Clean Water Act, they really separate waste streams into, in regulatory parlance, it's called non-point source pollution and point source. Point source are pipes and smokestacks, and non-point is landscape runoff. And it could be argued today that some of these real big dairy operations, the concentrated animal feeding operations, they're so big now, and the manure lagoons are so vast that they are arguably, by definition, point source polluters, and more needs to be done to make sure that all that manure that is generated every day, just like milk, is dealt with safely. And there, you referred to it earlier as waste, and that's how I think of it, too, or that's how I used to think of it. But if you go back to what the British were willing to do, to get their crops to grow, they would see these manure lagoons not as mounds of goo that needed to be gotten rid of. They would see it as just a fertilizer trove, and that's exactly what it is, and that's what we need to start recognizing and managing for.
Yeah, I mean, near the end of your book, you do talk about how some of that is being done. And I can think of some examples in Wisconsin of some of the large farms that are actually doing that and providing heat for, I'm trying to think now, in the Watertown area, the farm there that is providing heat for a lot of homes because
yeah,
they're...
A lot of methane. And so they get a lot of methane from manure, but they can also get the phosphorus, and it can be treated to the point where it's going to be as pure as anything that's coming from a chemical fertilizer factory. But it's going to cost money. The thing is, and I don't want to demonize agriculture at all, because I had breakfast this morning, and I'll have lunch today and dinner tonight and do it all over again tomorrow. We need, desperately, obviously, we need agriculture. They're just operating within the system that they've inherited, but the system isn't working, because just as much as we need food, we need water, and they're kind of on a collision course right now, and that's really what I'm trying to, the point I'm trying to make, or the picture I'm trying to sketch with this book, this idea that we can't keep going down the path that we're on, because we're just trashing the water, and we're running out of it at the same time. So we need to restore this circle, and that means being smarter and better at turning manure into precise fertilizer that can be administered in the right place at the right time.
So what's in store for us for the future of phosphorus and the amounts of phosphorus and our ability to grow food?
Well, you know, some people were saying 5 or 6 years ago that globally we're on path to run out of, you know, at least accessible phosphorus reserves within 70, 80 years, and others say, oh, it's 350, 400 years. Either scenario is not that far off if you think about it. And there's a way out of this. It's just to start reusing it instead of one and doneing it. And that's where we got to go toward.
Yeah. And when you look at Morocco, the king of Morocco, an individual controlling 80% or so of the phosphate trade in the world today.
Not the trade yet, but it's coming. I mean, those are the reserves, the supplies, but they're going to become a powerhouse going forward. So, yeah, the thing is we don't have to run out of it to have problems either. We can just, you know, have regional scarcity, and you know, if one country is hungry, everybody should be concerned, because that's not a stable country.
Yeah,
and if a bunch of countries are you know, desperate for phosphorus, you're talking global security issues.
Jeff and Gaze Mills will go to you next. Jeff, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to mention that there's a company that makes portable wastewater treatment machines, and that's really what they are. They're not permanently placed. You can have them on the back of a truck, and you can roll them into one of these animal farms and treat all their waste just like you would, you know, we do at municipalities. And you can also have them designed to take out the phosphates, and then you could compost the solids and collect the methane. It's possible. It's just expensive, and they don't want to do it.
Yeah. Comment, Dan?
Yeah. Yeah, no, I agree. It is expensive, but milk is relatively cheap right now in terms of dollars and cents. Or depending on where we, you know, fluctuates wildly. But overall, milk is pretty darn cheap. Unless you start factoring in these external costs, like your ability to not swim in Lake Mendota on a hot August afternoon, that's a cost of producing milk. And it doesn't appear in any ledger, but it's real. And so we're paying for this one way or the other, and it's going to get more and more expensive in that respect. So, yeah, the encouraging thing is there are a host of emerging technologies. And I say at the outset of the book, I believe, I never know what the editors do, but I'm assuming it's still in there, that I'm not writing this book to put us on a technological path or to say this is the system we need to use. I'll leave that to, you know, bigger minds. I'm just trying to paint the picture. That being said, when I went to Hamburg, the place of phosphorus discovery, and then the place that phosphorus burned down. Coincidentally, Hamburg is also leading the way in wastewater recovery to the point where they've got a system in Hamburg. It just came online last year. That's going to meet new German standards that will require almost all phosphorus to be pulled from wastewater, from human wastewater treatment streams. And so they've got one system, but there are multiple systems, and there's a lot of smart people working on this. So it's not dire. It's just time to start doing it on the scale that needs to happen to keep our water safe.
Well, I think you've done a marvelous job explaining in your book the effects one way or the other. I mean, the dire situation that exists in several areas, of even in this country. And I want to thank you so much, Dan. How's the book doing, by the way? Or I suppose it's pretty early in the day for that.
Yeah, it's only been out for 2 weeks. Came out on March 7th, and I think it's doing well. I got a picture from my editor who was at JFK Airport a couple nights ago, and it was next to one of Oprah's pics in the airport bookstore. So it's different from the Great Lakes book in that it's not a regional book. It really is meant to have a national, if not beyond that, readership. And hopefully it does well. I mean, it's not a sciencey book. I'm not a sciencey guy. It's just an issue that I think is screaming to be brought to the public's attention, and that's what I'm trying to do with this book.
Well, I want to thank you so much, and I know you're on the road today, and I certainly appreciate you calling in and talking with us today on the phone as you're probably sitting in your van or your car right now, Dan. Thank you so much. Thank you so much for being with us. Are you working on another book?
Oh, come on. It just came out 2 weeks ago.
Well, when your next one comes out, let us know. We'll get you back on and we'll do it again. Thanks, Dan.
It's been a pleasure. Yeah, thank you. Have a good day.
Dan Egan, his book is titled The Devil's Element. We just touched barely on it. He's a great writer, and I know you're going to find it an interesting read. Dan Egan, The Devil's Element, the name of the book. Well, tomorrow we'll talk about setting up a home-based food business, for one thing, and then our attorneys, one of our attorneys is back to give you some real estate legal advice. What do you think about that? In the meantime, stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller.